Yo, what's cracking? It's your homeboy Ice Cube, and you tuned in to Everything Snowboarding and More podcast. You know what it is, baby.
Welcome back to the Everything Snowboarding and More podcast. This is episode number 39. My name is Mike Hardiker, and I'm your host for this episode. This week, we are featuring Les Stroud. Les Stroud is also known as Survivor Man. This is a really, really fun interview. We talked about the outdoors, we talked about gear, a little bit of everything else as well. This week's podcast is being sponsored once again by Spark R&D, reliable manufacturer of badass splitboard bindings. For more information, check out sparkrnd.com. Welcome back, everybody. This week's guest is known as Survivor Man. You've probably seen him on TV. He had a hit show. Oh, I think he was on TV for 18, 20 years now. Les Stroud, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you very much.
So, Les, we're based here in Jackson, Wyoming, and it gets cold in the winter. I just got your new book. And what are some tips that you might have for some of our readers and listeners that spend time recreating in the cold? What's some great ways to just kind of be out there when its temperatures are less than ideal?
Oh, I think one of the first ones usually out of my mouth for the question like that comes to winter and cold is always going to be based on what are you wearing? And I think that, a big, thick one-piece snowmobile suit is fantastic if you're sitting on a snowmobile or riding a snowmobile or you're sitting at an ice fishing hole, but absolutely terrible if you need to move, if you need to do anything that gets your muscles moving because you become overheated so quickly. So I'm a massive fan of layering. In fact, even in that situation, I just would layer up a lot if I knew I was going to be sitting on a snowmobile, for example. But basically layering, because once you layer, you know, you can layer up, you can layer down. It's a little tedious. I've had times where I've put a jacket on and off, you know, every 12 minutes kind of thing because, the sun's out and I'm on the trail in snowshoes, but it's no wind. Now I'm sweating. Oh, the sun's gone in and I'm walking on the frozen lake and the wind's blowing. Oh, I'm freezing. So layering up and layering down is a big thing for me. And one little side tip, this is a controversial one because I hear guys kind of sort of debating it, but I firmly stand on the side of that. As long as you are between the hours of daylight, you're warm, you might be working, and it's before, say, 4 p.m. on a cold winter's day, staying hydrated is massively important. And if the only way you can do that is to eat snow, I say eat it. You want to make sure it's clean snow, but otherwise I eat lots of snow until about late in the day. And then you want to be careful because if you're doing any kind of survival stuff or even sleeping in a tent for that matter, you can cool down really quickly by eating snow. So there is a caveat to it, but there's a couple of tips for you.
Well, I love the layering aspect. We do a lot of ski touring here and splitboarding. And a lot of times when people are at the trailhead, you see them with their big heavy down and they start their ski tour that way. And within, 5-10 minutes, as you mentioned, all of a sudden that gets put into the pack. And then it's kind of, that layering aspect, maybe you just use your shell or maybe you even put the shell on the pack, go out and walk for, 2-3 hours. And then all of a sudden you get to where you're going and then you can put that layer back on. But the part about the hydration, that's really interesting. So basically, like if you go out and you're really dehydrated and you start sweating out there, layering kind of comes second to the dehydration. Is that correct?
Oh, I wouldn't prioritize it either which way. I mean, and that's the thing is you can't do that. You can't do the once and for all ultimate piece of gear, once and for all ultimate survival technique, once and for all thing you must do. It doesn't work like that. It will depend on the situation. You may be in a situation where dehydration can be second to layering or where layering can be second to dehydration. It's way too many variables to just put a pin in that,
And as far as like base layers, do you find merino wool or synthetics? Is there anything that you like to have kind of next to skin?
Yeah, and I'll take the question further and say as a general rule, my preference has been to combine new, synthetic, hyper-professional, kind of worked on sort of researched and designed clothing with some old school clothing. And the base layers for me tend to be the new stuff, the synthetic stuff. I mean, and it's interesting because again, you got to take everybody's body into consideration. Not all of us sweat a lot. I sweat a lot. My wife doesn't. So we're going to require two different kinds of base layering. But I do like anything that has a wicking component to it. And sometimes I find the thinner, the better for base layers. But, you know, with a guy who does get a high temperature going in his body when he's working out, that's me, I may find myself, you know, skiing shirtless. Now, sometimes they're like, oh, you guys are looking all macho. No, if I don't, I'm just soaking my shirt. That's why I'm shirtless. So I'm okay if my nipples get cold right now. You know what I'm saying? So base layers for me, I like the high tech. And as far as when you say like what you know, because we've been through so many versions, the capillines and the nylons and the different synthetics that are available, I say yes to all of them because they all have their place. They all have different research methodologies that have been done to how they were created. So you got to try them all out. You gotta, and that's fun. I mean, there's nothing that's not, you know, it's completely fun to test out clothing all the time until you go, you know what? No matter what I do, I love this shirt. I love when it's on me. I think I'm even a better skier when I have it on. So that's kind of the way I look at it.
I love that. You know your gear. And what I do for a living is actually test gear. I had a conversation with Corey Simpson, the director of marketing over at Patagonia. And I kind of asked him, you know, hey, you guys are making all these base layers. Like I personally, like you, I sweat a lot. So there's times before I even, you know, get to the trailhead in my car, I'm sweating. And I found the thinnest type of a synthetic base layer, even a short sleeve for me works better just to kind of move that heat through my body. And then I have, you know, different capillines or things for a mid layer. But the layering is, it's an interesting thing. And like you said, it's a really important component to going out there. And especially if you're doing high output energy. And I've actually taken it as far as to bring a second base layer top, just knowing that if I plan to sweat through, I'm like, hey, you know, kind of like a fresh pair of socks. If you go out on a big day snowmobiling, you know, you put those on.
Yeah. I'm interrupting you, but what you said, cause I want to, because what you said is pretty vital. Just last weekend, I was snowshoeing in Crater Lake National Park and we got to lunchtime and it was just my wife and I and another couple and I pulled off my base layer shirt. So I'm skin now. And then I pulled out the dry one and my wife, you know, ever proud of me. She just judged. She goes, now that's a pro move right there. I said, you're damn right it is.
Wow.
I said, so, you know, and I mean, the thing is, look at it this way. You know, you might try to look super cool going out without anything, you know, any kit on your back or nothing in your backpack other than your power bar, you know, and your little flask and a little bit of water. Sure, that looks cool. You look pretty sleek, but, you know, it's going to suck for you when you do stop. And we always do stop, right? So I always, as a sweater, I hike constantly. I always have in my pack a spare pair of socks. Now, that's in case I step in creeks and things. Let's say I'm hiking in Oregon or something. I always have a shirt, and almost guaranteed, unless it's windy and sunny and I can dry out the shirt I was wearing, I'm switching shirts at lunchtime. And you know what? You say, well, that's kind of geeky. No, it's super comfortable. It's awesome. You know, so I always promote that.
And that comes from your experience. That's so awesome to hear. You know, being Survivor Man, what other things should people have in their backpack if they're just going out for an outing? I mean, do you bring, you know, fire starters, like first aid kit? What are some of the extra little things that, you know, a lot of our, you know, readers and listeners, they go hunting and they go backpacking, a lot of backcountry skiers, you know, what are some other little things that they can bring aside from the layers and the socks?
Well, and let me approach it first because it's a favorite subject of mine. So let me approach it, and I apologize if I'm going to be verbose here, but I want to approach it first with the philosophy of this. You know, I see, and so do you, I bet, see so many people that I'll pass on the trail. I'm like, oh my God, they've got nothing with them. And they're going up to that peak and they're just like, and they might be in city shoes. So that's one level. The other level is probably more like your friends and my friends. They just don't feel they need it. You know, they've got their stuff down. They know what's going on and they don't feel like they really need much. And to have a backpack with stuff on, it's kind of geeky, isn't it? What are you, a Boy Scout? You know, you get that kind of, you know, noses get turned up at it. But the funny thing is, you know, when anything does hit the fan and you're the guy with some gear in his pack, you're no longer the Boy Scout geek. You're now the hero. And so I highly recommend that you have a pack with good stuff in it. Now, not so much so that you're like weighing yourself down, but on the other hand, so you got 15 pounds in your pack, you'll get stronger legs. You know, it's just going to work you out more. We're not saying carry 45 pounds worth of stuff, but you get somewhere between 7 and 15 pounds worth of gear. Now, what can you have for that? Well, you know the food, you know the water, so we don't need to touch on that. I generally speaking, well, actually, some toiletries is always fun to have in case duty calls while you're out there, so some toilet paper. The first aid kit, yes, but just like any survival kit, you got to know what's in your first aid kit. Don't just go buy a cute little red colored kit with a big X on it off the shelf. You got to know what's in that kit and how to use it. And lots of people, it's like the Survivor Man thing of having my flint stick hanging off my belt. I've seen other guys, and they don't even know how to use it. It's like, well, you're carrying it and you don't even know how to use it. So in your first aid kit, know what's there. But here's what you do with all of this. Don't buy anything off the shelf and throw it in your pack. Set it up yourself. So set up your own first aid kit. Mine is customized, and I couldn't, if a team of skiers had a massive accident and people's had arms laying around on the snow, no, I'm not set up to do that. But I'm certainly set up for blisters and cuts and small wounds and, you know, some things like that. Maybe a bit of compression if I'm going long term and stuff like that. And then the rest of it, as far as survival kit goes, really, and I bet you know this too, something to start a fire. Plus something to start a fire, plus something to start a fire.
I love it.
Because, man, if there's one thing that is vital in any situation where you're stopped and you've got to deal with something that's hitting the fan, you almost always want a fire. And scrambling with a small bit of matches and, you know, or a lighter that's got a few drops left in it, you want. So that's big for me. After that, you get into customization. If you want to know, if it's not too heavy, you know, a good knife and these sorts of things that you can see on any list. But the best advice really is to what's the activity? How long are you going for? What's the weather? What's your skill set? Now, okay, take that information and customize your kit. But I'll end it this way. Whatever you do, take a kit. Don't think you're too cool for it. You can get the most awesome, you know, sleek backpack from REI or Mountain Equipment Co-op or someplace like that and still look very cool and also be prepared at the same time.
Definitely. And, you know, I'll put a link up. We did an article on what to put in your first aid kit. And we had one of our Canadian mountain guide writers kind of put this together. And, you know, same thing. He said, you know, just don't buy it off the shelf. You know, what do you need? You know, maybe some gauze pads, maybe some stuff for blisters. One of the things that I carry with me, just because I'm with skiers in the wintertime, is a pair of trauma shears so that if I did have to cut somebody out of a ski boot, I could do that. As I switch over to hunting season, I actually have a whole different kit that I've put together that has more of tourniquets and things to stop bleeding and, you know, a little bit more of that first aid, knowing that we're out there, you know, playing with knives. But yeah, that's brilliant just to kind of know what's in your kit. As far as fire starter, I'm the guy that just carries a couple lighters with me. You know, I've got an Altoids tin that I put one in, and then I have cotton soaked Vaseline cotton balls or cotton balls soaked in Vaseline. And I found that, you know, if I can get the lighter to go, that's just an incredible way to get a fire going. I haven't really ever tried too much the other ways aside from a lighter or matches. Like, what would be a good introduction for somebody that wanted to add a second or third fire starter to their kit? Hmm. You know, sometimes the videos look easy and sometimes they don't. What's kind of the first, if somebody wanted to step up from matches and a lighter, what would you recommend?
Well, this is, you're asking a question. It's a bit of a double-edged sword. And anybody who's into like survival and watches Survivor Man and the other stuff and that and is probably going to hate me for this. Honestly, if you're asking me in this day and age, depending on what you're going to do and you're not specifically trying to learn any more, shall we say, old fashioned survival skills, my first answer is more of what you already have. So but the flint striker, the ferro rod, yeah, fine, whatever. Give me a butane lighter. I'm in trouble. I need a fire. You know, so I'm saying with reality, more of the cotton, you know, the soaked cotton, more of another lighter, a fuller lighter, a butane. You know, I like the torch kind because they're really great in the wind, right? So first off, that's my true realistic answer. But to entertain your question further is to say, so then we get into the strikers. And the small ones and a lot of crappy ones out there, they're very cheap. I suppose Look, I do agree when a survival guy or woman hears this, I do agree that the striking edge on a magnesium flint striker stick is a little wimpy, a little small, and can fall out and can break and fall out. I do agree with that. So in that case, a larger ferrule rod, a larger striking rod would, you'd think would be better. However, the magnesium just gives you like a not kindling I'm looking for, but fuel, if you will. It's an extra little thing. So really, before we get into hitting rocks against pieces of steel, a simple ferrule rod, watch some videos on it, that sort of thing, because a lot of people, you know, they definitely, if you don't, I'll say it this way, I'll end this way and say that if you go to a ferrous rod, if you're going to go to a magnesium flint striker, any kind of flint striker, there's a technique to it. Don't think you can just grab it and make some sparks. That's not how it works. Watch some videos because there is a definite technique to it. And it takes funnily enough, a little more muscle than you think. Now, it's muscle directed in a very specific and strategic way. So it's not brute force, but you still need some strength and some muscle to, you know, maneuver your hands and, you know, to make them work. But that'd be the next logical step up. Long answer there, but yeah.
No, that's great.
Fire's important to me, as you can tell.
For sure. And the fact that you said, you know, use what you're comfortable with. And, you know, I love that you said fire, you know, three times and have that redundancy. One of the things that I notice in my backpack is most of the stuff that I carry ends up not being for myself, whether that's a repair kit, first aid, yeah. I bring extra goggles, I bring extra gloves. And, you know, sometimes, you know, they say here in the Tetons, the bigger your pack, the more stuff you're going to inherently bring. But when that happens and you know, you get strong and you get used to it, when a situation happens, like you said, you know, you go from Boy Scout to hero that quickly.
Yeah. You know what? And why not? You know, why not have stuff that's for everybody else? The one time you're going to need it for you, of course, is going to be fantastic. But for the most part, hopefully you're skilled enough that, generally speaking, it is for other people. And why not? You know, you don't have to bitch about the fact that they didn't bring what they should have. You know what you're doing. Don't deny your own skill set and your own kind of predictive mind management of what can happen out there. Go for it. And it is true. You can, I suggest, you know, I suppose after time you can become silly, but only if it drags you down, only if it holds you back. If you got strong legs, you know, go for it. You know, bring a tent, even if you're not going camping, whatever you like, because yeah, this, so it's not even balancing a line between being geeky or not. It's really just go to the place of your greatest comfort. But I would suggest don't let that be nothing. You know, find the place of where you're most comfortable and how much you carry and get to that stage, because yeah, then you can be the hero and somebody else. By the way, one more tangent comment on just before we finish the lead subject of fire. It's not enough to have a great, you know, butane lighter with a great torch flame and some wax caught. That's not enough, because I've watched people, you know, try to get roaring fires going with toilet paper. It ain't going to happen. You also, the real next step, here's a better next step. Go out in as many circumstances as you can and see what it takes to get a fire going, especially in the rain. You know, especially in the rain, so you can have lighters, you can carry them, but you know, I do it to my wife all the time when we go camping. It's like you're on fire, because I know she's not as good as I am, or that good originally, at getting a fire going. So I kind of force it upon her, say, "Well, you got the lighter," and she gets better at it. But most of us carry lighters, and we suck at getting fires going. So go and practice that fire starting.
Wow. And in the rain too, you know, even in the snow, it's tough, but gosh, in the rain, you know, and everything's damp and, yeah. Les, where are you from? I noticed a little bit of an accent in your voice.
Canada.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, it's Canadian. Yeah. I'm from Ontario.
Okay. And did you grow up kind of playing outdoors? Was this kind of a natural progression for you?
I grew up desiring it. So I grew up in the teenage era. The TV era of the 70s. I grew up with, you know, where I watched Jacques Cousteau and Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom and there wasn't a National Geographic on TV then. So I grew up desiring it, wanting it. I did not come from a family that was an outdoor family. I had to I had to achieve my outdoor goals entirely of my own volition. And I'm really quite a late bloomer. Now, that said, I knew the desire was always there because even as a, you know, beer drinking teenager, my buddies used to nicknamingly nickname me Yule Gibbons. Now, Yule Gibbons wrote a number of edible wild plants books because I, you know, even as a dumbass 17-year-old would, you know, say, hey, guys, I'm pretty sure we can eat these plants here. And which would be followed with, shut up, Stroud. So, you know, I definitely grew up not near any kind of outdoor pursuits. I just wanted it badly. And I went after it when I I was 25 when I first became an outdoor adventurer.
That's great. You know, and it seems like you're really passing on the torch to the next generation. Your new book coming out, Wild Outside. It's interesting. When I got it, it said, you know, for ages 8 to 12. And here I am, you know, I've got it on my coffee table and I read it all the time. And anybody that comes over, you know, they start flipping through and there's all sorts of just really cool tidbits. How did the idea come about to make a book and kind of gear it toward children?
Well, it's really just a wonderful natural extension of what I've been doing for 20 years now in film and 35 years in practice. And that is that even though Survivor Man itself and even Beyond Survival, sure, these series were on, you know, you could ostensibly call them adult television networks, you know, but kids still love them. And I used to get photographs from kids dressing up as me for Halloween. I mean, if that's not an endorsement, I don't know what is, right? So this Wild Outside with Anik Press out of Toronto gave me the opportunity to speak directly to the kids, which I did years ago when I used to run outers clubs and guide trips and everything long before Survivor Man. I guided kids for hundreds of trips out into the wilderness. So this gave me that opportunity to speak directly to them. And it's sort of trifold in that, you know, I get to direct them. I get to tell them my stories of Survivor Man. And then I get to tell them the lessons learned from those stories. And then I get to give them some practical application and some fun they can have outside, even in their backyard. So there's a nice trifecta of directives there. And as I said, it gave me the opportunity to speak directly to that age group.
And how about, I mean, you talked about going out with your wife. Do your children share that same passion for the outdoors that you do?
They do. And thankfully, of their own accord and in their own way. So they both love adventuring. So they both will hike and kayak and mountain climb and do these sorts of things. And then my daughter went off into being a triathlete. She's a triathlete, notwithstanding the issues with the Olympics these years with COVID, but she's still training hard as a triathlete, swim, bike, run. And my son is a smoke jumper and a paramedic, but he's out in British Columbia. So he's just, he is far from you guys. But anyway, he's up in the mountains in British Columbia. And so both of them definitely went down that road. They definitely got wilderness adventures with myself and my ex-wife. But I'm glad to see they made it their own. They took their own direction. They didn't become little survivor men, you know, little survivor children or something like that. They made their own out of it.
And it's interesting, you know, again, you mentioned on their own accord. A lot of the parents here, I think, in certain, you know, resort towns or active communities, they really, really push their children. And we've kind of seen it backfire a lot where it's like, hey, my kid's going to come ski with me. And the children get to a certain point and they're like, you know, I don't want to go ski. Like, I kind of want to go do something else. Or they move away from the community. So it's great to see that, you know, your children, you know, picked up on your love for the outdoors and kind of ran with it.
Well, I don't think you can force anything on your kids. I don't think you should. And I'm speaking as a parent of two children. It's you can open up the opportunities, but when it becomes a thing, it becomes a bit of drudgery for them. And even though, you know, skiing at the most awesome mountain with a great set of equipment, it might seem, you know, and they love it and they're 11 and 12 years old. And, well, your friends over there, their kids took it and they went professionally with it. So you're hoping your kids will too. Do you know what? Let them, you know, open those opportunities up for them. But by the same token, if they have to sit around the table, you know, listening to you talk to your adult friends and they'd rather be somewhere else, you know, you're not noticing that, you know? So you have to be really careful. It's about opening the opportunities up, making them all available, and just seeing what sticks. I've tried many things with my kids that did not stick. And thing is, I don't take it personally. You know, it's like, okay, well, you don't like that. Cool. What do you like? How about this? You know, point is, as a parent, whether it's skiing or, you know, at the Canadian hockey, you know, they wanted to play soccer. I never played soccer. They play soccer. So yeah, that's the thing. We do have to be careful as outdoor parents that we don't, you know, try to turn our young children into little, perfectly clad in the best outdoor clothing, miniature versions of ourselves. I don't think that's the goal of parenthood. So.
They sure do have cool looking kids' clothes now. That wasn't the case when I was a kid.
Well, you know, when you were talking earlier about the clothing, and I made mention of the fact that I like to combine the new high tech and the old school. Well, one of the reasons for that is if I'm doing a survival excursion, and we'll call it a recreational survival excursion, because of course it's recreational because I'm not actually in a survival situation. I'm just going to go do this for the weekend. I like to be clad on the outside with more old school, more wools and canvases and tougher stuff, because you want to wear some Gore-Tex and build a shelter and sleep beside a fire. That's the end of that Gore-Tex coat that night, right? Whereas you've got a beat up old, you know, army wool kind of thing, that's going to last you forever. So I do like, in survival anyway, in sports is different, but in survival and in recreational survival, I should say, there's a big distinction there. I do like combining the old and the new.
I like that you're talking wool. I feel like I'm kind of doing it right now, talking to you. There's a hunting show, a guy named Randy Newberg. And for the longest time, his gloves, he uses these big chopper mitts, kind of like a deer hide chopper mitt. And then inside, he has big, heavy wool liners. And I thought, you know, this guy, you know, he goes hunting. He's always out in the cold. I get to test all these really cool, you know, North Face and, you know, Dakine and all these Gore-Tex and insulated gloves. I've found that the wool liner with the big, you know, leather chopper mitt on top, it keeps my hands the warmest out of anything. And people laugh and they're like, "You're using wool?" I'm like, "This is like old, like military style. I mean, it works." And for somebody like yourself to, you know, understand that and to be using a combination of the two, I mean, that's great. I definitely feel like I'm on the right track. This is cool.
Oh yeah, absolutely. You catch me in a real winter situation, I'm wearing my moose hide mitts with beaver fur liner or wool liners. Absolutely. Okay. And when I wear the high tech stuff, well, it's real simple. My fingers get cold. So I don't care. It's not about how cool I look. And you know, and again, all of our physiologies, if you will, are different. Now, for example, I ran dog teams for 3 years, and here's a story for you. What happens when you run dog teams is the dog teams learn how to poop on the run. While they poop on the run, often it could be, at least up in the Arctic when you're feeding them fish all the time, it can be very runny poo. So now this poo gets on the chains and things that are behind them, including the clasps that hold the chains together. Now you have to come along at the end of the day and undo these clasps to take the dogs off of the team. Problem is, there's now a bigger than golf ball sized dog poo lump that's frozen solid on the clasp. Now you have to take that dog poo off. So you have to thaw it. Now you're thawing dog poo with your bare hands on cold metal. So I had to do that for 3 years of running dog teams. Well, here's, and now to get to my point, the result of that is I suffer from a traumatic Raynaud's syndrome. And mostly that it affects women more in a natural sense, but in a traumatic sense, I got it from freezing my fingers over and over again. What's that mean? It means that the second I get cold or my body senses a chill, it aggressively reacts to pull the blood out of my fingertips, which means I need to keep my hands warm when I'm out on a winter excursion. Simple. And my high-tech gloves with the individual fingers, they don't do it. I've tried them. I've used them a million times. What works? Leather gloves with wool interiors. That's what works.
Wow, I like that. And then how about hand warmers? Do you ever bring those along or just throw some in your kit?
I do. If it's really cold, yeah, you bet. I mean, why not? That's, like I said, I'm not purist about it. Always blending the modern and new and synthetic with the old. And that's new, if you will. So yeah, absolutely. Hand warmers, find the, you know, well, okay, here's another story for you in that respect. I have, maybe you can tell me this because I just haven't done enough research, but I have a jacket that was sent to me years ago. And I actually told, I said, well, if you ever want to do something with me, I'm into it. And I never heard back from them, but I got this jacket. It is an electric jacket. It's got one of those heaters in the back of it. And I must have had it in the closet for 6 years, never touched it. Then I got, you know, I'm snowshoeing in Oregon a lot with my wife in a Crater Lake area. So we always stop for lunch, and our lunches tend to be very leisurely. So now I'm, you know, you start to chill down when you're, and we sit in the snow with our chocolate laps, right? And we've got little seats that we sit on, but just the same. So I thought, I'm going to try this jacket thing. Plugged it in, took it out on the next snowshoeing thing. And lunchtime, stop. I pull off, you know, whatever I was wearing. I was probably feeling a little bit sweaty, a little bit warm at the time, but you start to feel that little chill. Oh, there it is coming in. You know, maybe I switched my shirt. I put on the electric coat. Oh my God, it was awesome. I sat there in the greatest of luxury. You know, it's got a 3-hour heating thing on it. And I'm like, I'm really sorry, honey, but I'm not letting you wear this coat because this is awesome. So any kind of supplemental heat that helps you stay warm when you need it. Look, man, the greatest thing you can do out in your adventures is be comfortable. And being comfortable is like an art form out there. Why suffer? I've suffered a lot out there, as you know, and I'm not for that.
You know, this has been a really fun conversation, Les. I love that we've talked gear and being comfortable in the backcountry, you know, whether it's camping or your day trip. So many people now are on the kind of the ultralight thing. They want to just shed as many grams as possible and be in the single person tent. If I'm backpacking by myself, I love a 2-3 person tent. Like, I'd rather have the space so I can put all my stuff inside, and I bring a really nice sleeping pad. And if I bring a sleeping bag, it's always the extra long sleeping bag. I mean, I just don't mind because I want to be comfortable out there, and I love sleeping under the stars and just even recreating. It makes it so much more fun when you do have the right gear and you know how to use it, combined with, you know, being in a place that you're comfortable with. And I guess last but not least, what are some common injuries that you've seen out there that have happened to you that, you know, maybe people can kind of plan for when we're talking about a first aid kit or just in general?
The easiest of common injuries is a simple blister. You know, the thing is, a blister will knock you down. It'll take you off your feet, you know, a bad one. And in adventure racing, we used to have a thing where if your teams of four and you're adventure racing, multi-day races, that kind of thing, backwoods. If you felt a hot spot coming in your ankle, you would yell out hot spot. And the other three members would instinctively always say, thank you. Why? The reason is because if you try to, you know, man that out and just like tough it out, that hotspot's going to turn into a horrifying blister and eventually it's going to shut the team down. When you go early on blisters and say hotspot and you fix it, well, sure, you're losing 4.5 minutes to put that blister thing on there, but you're saving the race. And so blisters will knock you down quicker than you think. Burns are another one that I tend to see, especially if you're going to have outdoor fires. You know, you get these little burn situations, everything from you grab the wrong stick and there was a coal on the end of it and you didn't see it, to the horrific pouring of bacon grease from the frying pan on the forearm kind of stuff. And so burns are one. Second skin is something I like to keep, second skin in my first aid kits, sort of thing. And eyes, you know, that's a tricky one. One of the things that I tend to keep that I would kind of almost feel like it's an extra, but I still do, is I like to keep the little eye cup with the eye cleansing liquid. That's I've actually used that more times, you know, and sometimes it's just dust around the campsite, you know, getting in your eye, but man, same thing, one little fleck in the eye will knock you down. So those are some common ones that I see.
Wonderful. Well, I really appreciate you taking the time to chat with us. This has been really fun. You know your gear, you know the outside. Survivor Man, thanks so much. Where can people follow along with your adventures these days?
Well, one thing I'll do is, and this is the shameless plug section, but I love it because we'll go back to the book Wild Outside. It's coming out in March from Anik Press. And if you are a parent and you have kids between the ages of 5 and 16, it's really directed toward them. It's I wrote it. It's my words. There's no ghostwriting. It's my stories. I hope you will at least take a look at it. But the whole goal, the whole point, as it's been with everything I've ever done, is just to get people connected to nature again. And that's the point of that book, is to connect kids, your kids, to nature. Online is easy. I am putting up tons on YouTube these days. Survivor Man - Les Stroud. Most, if not all, of my Survivor Man episodes will be up there. Survivor Man, Bigfoot, Beyond Survival, and all kinds of other material and how-tos and director's commentaries. So my YouTube channel is a really big focus. online, I'm easy to find, and I've got the requisite Instagrams and Twitters and all of that. And that's me. It's actually me doing it all. But the last thing I would say is I have a brand new podcast myself. It's out right now. It's called Surviving Life with Les Stroud. And it's on wherever you get your podcasts. And I'm interviewing everybody from musicians to outdoor legends. So it's a wide span. So that's it. I'm pretty busy these days. 2021 is going to be a year of constant releases for me. Oh, before I even forget, what am I talking about? Brand new series on PBS stations called Wild Harvest, which highlights local foraging. And then another series called Surviving Disasters with Les Stroud comes out in the spring. So busy guy these days, but it's fun to be busy and just keep releasing stuff.
Well, thanks again, the busy survivor man, Les. It's been a pleasure to talk to you and wish you the best.
All right. Have fun out there.
All righty. Bye. All right. Thanks for tuning in. That was episode number 39 with Les Stroud. Next week, we've got another special guest, Scotty Lago, another Olympian coming on the show. Should be a rad episode.